Throughout the day, some squally winds with them, rumbles of thunder too, a high of 8. And for Scotland, the rain that we start with in Orkney and Shetland clears, and then many northern eastern areas have a predominantly dry and bright day. To the west and south, those showers get going, some of those heavy, blustery winds and highs of around 9. Neil.
All right, many thanks, Matt Taylor. Now on BBC Radio 4 we begin a new book of the week. First published in 1853, Solomon Northup's memoir, 12 Years a Slave, is an eloquent and unflinching account of life as a slave in the American South. It was the inspiration for Steve McQueen's Oscar-nominated film of the same title. The reader is Rashaan Stone.
Having been born a free man, and for more than 30 years enjoyed the blessings of liberty, and having at the end of that time been kidnapped and sold into slavery, where I remained until happily rescued in the month of January 1853, after a bondage of 12 years, it has been suggested that an account of my life and fortunes would not be uninteresting to the public. My object is to give a candid and truthful statement of facts, to repeat the story of my life, without exaggeration, leaving it for others to determine whether even the pages of fiction present a picture of more cruel wrong or a severer bondage. My father, though born a slave, and laboring under the disadvantages to which my unfortunate race is subjected, was a man respected for his industry and integrity. His whole life was passed in the peaceful pursuits of agriculture. He endeavored to imbue our minds with sentiments of morality and to teach us to place our trust and confidence in him who regards the humblest as well as the highest of his creatures. How often since that time has the recollection of his paternal counsels occurred to me, while lying in a slave hut in the distant and sickly regions of Louisiana, smarting with the undeserved wounds which an inhuman master had inflicted. When young, I had been principally engaged with my father in the labors of the farm. The leisure hours allowed me were generally either employed over my books or playing on the violin. On Christmas Day, 1829, I was married to Ann Hampton, a colored girl then living in the vicinity of our residence. From the time of my marriage to this day, the love I've borne my wife has been sincere and unabated. In March 1834, we removed to Saratoga Springs. After this time, I was generally employed through the visiting season, as also was Anne, in the United States Hotel. In winter seasons, I relied upon my violin, though during the construction of the Troy and Saratoga Railroad, I performed many hard days' labor upon that. At this time, we were the parents of 3 children, Elizabeth, Margaret, and Alonzo. Elizabeth, the eldest, was in her 10th year. Margaret was 2 years younger, and little Alonzo had just passed his 5th birthday. They filled our house with gladness. One morning, towards the latter part of the month of March, 1841, I was walking about the village of Saratoga Springs, thinking to myself where I might obtain some present employment until the busy season should arrive. I was met by 2 gentlemen of respectable appearance. They proposed to engage my services for a short period. They were connected, as they informed me, with a circus company, then in the city of Washington, that they were on their way thither to rejoin it, having left it for a short time to make an excursion northward. They remarked that they had found much difficulty in procuring music for their entertainments, and that if I would accompany them as far as New York, they would give me $1 for each day's services, and $3 in addition for every night I played at their performances. I at once accepted the tempting offer, both for the reward it promised and from a desire to visit the metropolis. In due course of time, we reached New York. They, however, began to importune me to continue south with them to Washington. They promised me a situation and high wages if I would accompany them. We proceeded to Washington, at which place we arrived just at nightfall and stopped at Gadsby's Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. The next day, we went to the Capitol and walked about the grounds. My friends, several times during the afternoon, entered drinking saloons and called for liquor. On these occasions, after serving themselves, they would pour out a glass and hand it to me. I did not become intoxicated, as may be inferred from what subsequently occurred. Towards evening, and soon after partaking of one of these potations, I felt extremely ill. My head commenced aching, a dull, heavy pain, inexpressibly disagreeable. They advised me to retire, but it was impossible to sleep. I was in sore distress, in most excruciating agony. I seemed to stand on the brink of madness. I was conscious of someone entering my room. There seemed to be several, a mingling of various voices, but how many or who they were, I cannot tell. From that moment, I was insensible. How long I remained in that condition, whether only that night or many days and nights, I do not know. But when consciousness returned, I found myself alone, in utter darkness, and in chains. Where was I? What was the meaning of these chains? Then did the idea begin to break upon my mind, at first dim and confused, that I had been kidnapped. At last, I heard footsteps approaching from without. A key rattled in the lock, and two men entered and stood before me. One of them was a large, powerful man, 40 years of age. His name was James H. Birch, as I learned afterwards, a well-known slave dealer in Washington. The person who accompanied him was a simple lackey named Ebenezer Radbourne. "Well, my boy, how y'all feel now?" said Birch. I replied that I was sick and inquired the cause of my imprisonment. He answered that I was his slave, that he had bought me, and that he was about to send me to New Orleans. I asserted aloud and boldly that I was a free man and that my name was Northup. I complained bitterly of the strange treatment I had received and threatened upon my liberation to have satisfaction for the wrong. Again and again, I asserted I was no man's slave and insisted upon his taking off my chains at once. He endeavored to hush me, as if he feared my voice would be overheard, but I would not be silent. Birch ordered the paddle and cat of nine tails to be brought in. I was seized by both of them and roughly divested of my clothing. Drawing me over the bench, face downwards, Radbourne placed his heavy foot upon the fetters between my wrists, holding them painfully to the floor. With a paddle, Birch commenced beating me. Blow after blow was inflicted upon my naked body. When his unrelenting arm grew tired, he stopped and asked if I still insisted I was a free man. I did insist upon it, and then the blows were renewed, faster and more energetically, if possible, than before. When again tired, he would repeat the same question, and receiving the same answer, continue his cruel labor. All this time, the incarnate devil was uttering most fiendish oaths. At length, the paddle broke, leaving the useless handle in his hand. Still, I would not yield. All his brutal blows could not force from my lips the foul lie that I was a slave. Casting madly on the floor the handle of the broken paddle, he seized the rope. This was far more painful than the other. I struggled with all my power, but it was in vain. I prayed for mercy, but my prayer was only answered with imprecations and with stripes. I thought I must die beneath the lashes of this accursed brute. At length, Rabin said that it was useless to whip me any more. Thereupon, Birch desisted, saying that if ever I dared to utter again that I was entitled to my freedom, that I had been kidnapped or anything whatever of the kind, the castigation I had just received was nothing in comparison with what would follow. He swore that he would either conquer or kill me. With these consolatory words, I was left in darkness as before. My wounds would not permit me to remain but a few minutes in any one position. So, sitting or standing or moving slowly around, I passed the following days and nights. I was heart sick and discouraged. In the course of several days, the outer door was thrown open, allowing me the liberty of the yard. There I found three slaves, one of them a lad of 10 years, a sprightly child that answered the name of Randall. I remained in Williams's slave pen about 2 weeks. The night previous to my departure, a woman was brought in, weeping bitterly, and leading by the hand a little child. They were Randall's mother and half-sister. On meeting them, he was overjoyed, clinging to her dress, kissing the child. The mother also clasped him in her arms, embraced him tenderly, and gazed at him fondly through her tears, calling him by many an endearing name. Emily, the child, was 7 or 8 years old, of light complexion, and with a face of admirable beauty. The woman was arrayed in silk, with rings upon her fingers and golden ornaments suspended from her ears. Her air and manners, the correctness and propriety of her language, all showed evidently that she had sometimes stood above the common level of a slave. She seemed to be amazed at finding herself in such a place as that. Her name was Eliza, and this was the story of her life, as she afterwards related it. She was the slave of a rich man living in the neighborhood of Washington. Years before, he had fallen into dissipated habits and quarreled with his wife. Leaving his wife and daughter in the house they had always occupied, he erected a new one nearby on the estate. Into this house he brought Eliza, and on condition of her living with him, she and her children were to be emancipated. She resided with him there 9 years, with servants to attend upon her, and provided with every comfort and luxury of life. Emily was his child. At length, for some cause, a division of his property was made. Eliza and her children fell to the share of the daughter. The day she was led into the pen, she had been brought from the estate into the city, under the pretense that the time had come when her free papers were to be executed, in fulfillment of her master's promise. Elated at the prospect of immediate liberty, she decked herself and her little Emmy in their best apparel and accompanied him with a joyful heart. On their arrival in the city, instead of being baptized into the family of freemen, she was delivered to the traitor, Birch. Eliza is now dead. Far up the Red River, where it pours its waters sluggishly through the unhealthy lowlands of Louisiana, she rests in the grave at last, the only resting place of the poor slave. How all her fears were realized, how she mourned day and night and never would be comforted, how, as she predicted, her heart did indeed break with the burden of maternal sorrow, will be seen as the narrative proceeds.
Rashawn Stone was reading 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. The book is abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Now, here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. Now, on BBC Radio 4, it's time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday, the 25th of February. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North at Sarah, South at Sarah, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low 90 miles west of Shannon, 964, expected Bailey, 973 by 1800 on Tuesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sarah, south at Sarah, southerly 4R5, backing southeasterly, 6 to gale 8.